We hope, as you've heard Julia share with us, we're reading from the Message, which is a very different paraphrase and translation. If you heard the word almanac, I don't think it was used in the Bible in Old Testament times, but he writes Peterson in a very easy way to understand, and I think a very explicit way, of the conversation that Job is having in the prose and poetry of the book of Job. A little over 7 months ago, on December the 14th, a 20-year-old man, Adam Lance, fatally shot 20 children and 6 adult staff members at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. Before driving to school, he'd shot his mother and then returned later to kill himself. Grace McDonald, a 7-year-old, was one of the 20 children who was killed. Her mother says she was a truly, truly special girl. Noting how the little 7-year-old loved wearing little bows in her hair. In a touching interview, the mother explained how Grace loved the peace symbol and how she would always draw the peace sign in the bathroom window as it fogged up from the shower. The day after the shooting, Mrs. McDonald was in the bathroom and saw evidence of the etching of the peace sign and the words, "Grace loves Mommy." The couple then in the interview described the moment they saw their daughter's white coffin at the funeral home. "You felt like the floor was falling beneath you," Mrs. McDonald said. "But the coffin became a canvas when she, her husband Chris, their surviving son Jack, took out Sharpie markers and began drawing all over Gracie's white coffin. By the time they were done, Mrs. McDonald said, it was so covered by all the things that Grace loved. Ice cream cones, lighthouses, seagulls. We had a peace when we left, noting that the coffin was full of drawings and notes from those who knew and loved her best. She was so beautiful, and we'll take comfort in remembering her beautiful smile, adding that Grace would not have wanted them to remember her any other way than with that pink bubblegum bow in her hair." Her mother says in the interview, "I take comfort that she's with friends and she's up there with her wonderful principal." The questions that we rose last week and those raised by the book of Job that we will continue in our own personal reading and then together next week. There's a lot of conversation going on. There's a lot of theology going on. And there's also, if you will pardon, a little bit of theodicy going on. As you know, theology is an attempt to study and learn about God. Theodicy focuses on the attempt to understand divine justice, or maybe the apparent lack of it. Theology has been with us forever. Theodicy was something that was come up by gentlemen later in life who were dealing with the struggles of earthquakes and tornadoes and disasters and how you put all that in with the divine justice of God. And the struggle continues. The word theodicy comes from the forming of two Greek words, theos, which means God, and dike, which is justice. And in the original meaning, it is the justification of God. The old thought was that God needed from us a good defense. And that was part of the process. As Tom Long, who I've read a great deal, his book actually 3 or 4 times, explains, in his opinion, there's been a shift. Tom Long was a Parker lecturer we had. He's down at the Candler Seminary in Georgia. He writes, and I quote, "More recent thought is that theodicy has come to have a somewhat different meaning, one that is less about putting God on trial and more about putting our faith to test." I don't know about you, but I think I like that better, because can we really put God on trial? It is not about coming up with excuses for God's behavior, he writes, in a world of evil, but how faith in a loving God is plausible given what we know and experience about suffering. End of quote. If we live long enough, we will suffer. If and when it happens, I think we will question, like Job, whether God is really playing fair. I have no doubt the questions will come. The answers will be hard to find. But I do know, and I know you believe, that as we know God, we can encounter Him in those mountaintop experiences of life. But as you also know, God can also be encountered in the rugged valleys of pain and suffering. We cry out to God in untold ways, whether publicly or privately. And I think in our questioning and our crying out, that too is an act of faith on our part. Last Sunday we saw how Job recognizes both the wealthy individual and the God-fearing man and most influential man in the East. And then in the heavenly realm that we hear about, God and the accuser got together and made a wager that when bad things happened to Job, he would curse God. We then witnessed the death of his 10 children, the destruction of all his wealth, his cattle, his servants, and he remained faithful to God. The bet is raised by God and the accuser in this heavenly realm that is taking place, and physical suffering comes to Job. But even in his pain, he still does not turn his back on God. He tells his wife, "We take the good days from God, why not also the bad days?" Maybe not bad theology there as well. The narrator of Job's story informs us about three friends. We know nothing of this relationship, but while Job is out on the trash heap scraping his sores with pottery pieces, they arrive: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And what do? They come and sit with him. We are told for 7 days and nights they just sat with Job without saying a word, for they knew that he was suffering. When you and I visit someone who has experienced loss or is suffering, as we're getting closer to their house or to the door, we often wonder, what should we say? When in reality, just being with one in the midst of their pain and suffering is what is needed. Not some words that really they do not hear or do not want to hear. It's the best thing that almost anyone can do when comforted by grief and pain, is not to try to make everything okay, even if we could, by our words or actions, but just sit in silence with those who are hurting, to remind them by your presence that God is present with them and they are not alone. The ministry of presence. Most of the time, when one speaks, they actually make things worse. The three friends sit with Job for 7 days and 7 nights. But Job comes to a point that he has finally had enough, and he breaks the silence of the moment and begins to curse the fate that God has given him. Now, curse is more of a debate with God, going back and forth. I don't know about you, but I begin to really identify more with Job now because he seems more like us. Job was then questioning the conventional wisdom of his religion, which said simply, good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. God rewards those who are just and he punishes those who are wicked. The good prosper, the evil perish. Simple. But maybe not so. For now we begin to see that Job is questioning this theology because something has happened to him. And when he did, his friends choose to defend with vengeance the theology that he knows. Job starts out wishing that the night of his conception, the day of his birth, would literally be obliterated from the calendar like he never ever existed. Often, I think this is how it is with us when we go through grief. We become so consumed with our own sorrow that we expect the universe to notice, and we can't understand why the world is gone and has nothing has happened, but has happened to us. From cursing to raising questions, Job wants to know, why God? Why? And like most of us, the friends who had sat there for 7 days and 7 nights could only remain silent so long, and they began to speak. And for the following 39 chapters, we're not going to read all those, written in a very poetic style, if you read other translations, and we become witnesses to the dialogue between Job and his friends. They give out speeches, followed by a reply from Job. All this is back and back. No real movement, but just concentrating on the same thing one time after another. If you take the opportunity to read the speeches, you will note that the friends state and restate their case and nothing happens. Tom Long says Eliphaz is seeing the power of prayer as a bargaining chip. Peace with God as a negotiating device. He does not have faith, he maintains. He has a religious machine. I pray to God, he'll do this. I'm good, he'll do this. Bildad, on the other hand, sees disasters as well-deserved punishments. He tells Job, your children must have sinned. That's why they all were killed. He punishes them just as they deserve. Zophar maintains that Job has a clarity problem. He just doesn't understand that he is a sinner. In Nurturing Faith, the writer suggests, Job will insist throughout this dialogue, these poems, that he is an innocent victim, a good man that the world and God has turned against. His friends, again, will insist that that's the way the world works. Again, their theology is bad things happen because of bad behavior. Good things happen because of good behavior. And they are dogmatic in these 39 chapters, driving home that point after the point again and again. How many of us, intentionally or not intentionally, try to help explain the unexplainable? Everything happens for a reason, we might say. If you have enough faith, you won't have to suffer. If you have enough faith, You won't have to suffer. That was also Job's theology and Job's thinking until his world fell apart and he began to suffer. He was a righteous man. It is natural, I think, for us to try to make sense of the crises of our lives. However, just because we can add up the facts, 1 plus 1, it doesn't always help, does it? To understand the physics of a car accident or the biology of cancer or the sociology of an affair does not make the pain go away. What helps us? What helps us make it through the circumstances and the suffering is the strength we gain from our loved ones and our loving God. Job's problem is that his beloved friends have turned against him and his beloved God he seems not able to find. Sadly, the three friends that at the beginning were a comfort to Job now have become his accusers. They fail to understand really what is happening. Tony Cartledge writes, "Job listened to his friends but flatly rejects their claim that God cannot be questioned. He maintains his innocence and calls into question God's actions. He dares to suggest that someone should confront God with the question that he does in chapter 9, verse 12. God, what are you doing?" In the end, the friends seem to love the religious system of the day. But Job loves God. And unlike them, Job is willing to give up his theology. He is willing to struggle to understand what is happening. And maybe the sad part is that many of us, including myself, I believe that Job's friends often mirror us in the fact that Job's friends often refuse to enter into his world of pain and suffering, let alone his questions he raised, because we are uncertain of what to say or what to do. They had a sense of security. They had a sense of comfort. It seems that it would not allow them to move beyond anything but where they stood with their preconceived answers. And while most of us have little patience with Job's friend, isn't it surprising to you how much we are often like them? Again, how often do we find that we have to speak or do things and say, "God knows what He's doing," or "everything does happen for a reason," or "one day you will understand"? And who of us has questioned, "What have I done when things go wrong?" Or we say, "I've tried to be a good person. Why would God allow this to happen to me?" There are those, there are us, who might find comfort in those words. But on the other hand, do we really know the pain and suffering of the Jobs of our world? William Sloan Coffin was the pastor of Riverside Baptist Church in New York City. His son died of a terrible accident. And he went to say to one person, "The one thing that we should never say when someone dies, it is the will of God." Never do we know enough to say that. Would we even be here worshiping God if we thought that God killed the 20 children at Sandy Hook Elementary? Would we be serving a God who causes cancer? Those who suffer long to hear of a God who joins them in their suffering rather than wondering if He causes their pain. Where did we ever get the idea or the notion that we had to defend God anyway? Job's friends must have thought they did. God is big enough to hear us even if we're yelling at the top of our voices. In his commentary on Job, Samuel Ballantyne expressed it this way, and I quote, "When pushed to the limits, perhaps this is the ultimate expression of faith." And he says, "To pray without the certainty of a hearing, to believe when experience does not warrant it, to carve out life step by painful step, even when death seems more desirable." It's worth repeating. When we are pushed to the limit, if we can pray without the certainty of a hearing, if we can believe when experience does not warrant it, if we can carve out life step by step, even when death seems more desirable, God is there. I once heard that if you do not expect a lot from God, you will never be disappointed in God. As you know, it takes a lot of faith to say the things and to question like Job said and did in his loss. If we find ourselves identifying more with Job, and we all one day or another will be called Job, there are only really two things required. One, you must have enough pain in your life to wish God would fix it, and enough faith in your heart to wonder why God has not. Enough pain in your life to wish God would fix it, and enough faith in your heart to wonder why God has not. Is Job going to answer all the suffering questions of the world? Stay tuned. Is God going to answer Job? We'll see. But because of a thing called resurrection, the Jobs of the world, you and I, can have hope. Thanks be to God.